In some instances, the two curves will have multiple intersections. Now, the curves may not exist at all, but the theoretical marketing types often like to use them, and they sometimes are helpful. A multiple intersection allows a choice of selling fewer units at a higher price or more at a lower price. Now the decision must be made on the comparison of profits, on the knowledge of available capital to produce the products, or some other factors. I ran into such a problem in connection with a particular computer peripheral, which at one price, this peripheral would be used with one line, one price level of systems, but at a lower price, it would also be attractive on an additional line, lower price systems. The high price, low volume situation, interestingly enough, won out. But here, mostly because the high volume situation would have negatively impacted sales of an existing product. It's clear that for some products, near parallelism of the two curves, that is the demand curve and the cost curve, cost of manufacture, so on, near parallelism leads to a ping-pong effect between development and marketing. If one side sends their requirements to the other and the other sends it back, you know this kind of multiple intersection thing tends not to converge. So well-coordinated market planning, coordination between development and marketing, has definite advantages in this type of situation. The third point, how do we create a demand large enough to meet our sales goals? That is, how do we push this dog? Methods are tailored for an individual product. Public advertising may be needed for low-cost products of wide appeal, while direct solicitation of prospects by the top management of the company may be best for other high unit price products. Marketing people with experience in the specific product areas should be able to estimate the effectiveness of sales promotions of various kinds, but I'm afraid nowhere in the business field is science less rewarding. An expensive advertising campaign is resorted to by large and experienced firms, and sometimes by young and brash ones. Except through direct mail order selling, small firms seldom enter mass market selling of low price products. And by the way, the rule of thumb for mail order selling is that your sales price should be equal to or greater than 4 times the product cost. I was told that by a very successful guy who's a mail order seller in his spare time. And he learned it from some other guy, so it's gospel. Number four, how to get the product into the hands of customers. In distribution, which is what we are talking about here, the price of the product unit package is a major factor. The lower the price, the wider the distribution, you hope. The more levels in the distribution chain, and of course, the higher the so-called markup. But interestingly enough, the same 4-to-1 ratio of price to direct product cost is applied by some very large and successful firms which deal directly with the purchaser. So QED, the most successful firms don't spend 80% of the cost of the product manufacturing it. Quite a bit of analysis is often used in the design of a product distribution system for products such as household goods, where levels of inventory, delivery response time, perishability, packaging, and method of shipment are all important variables. Since sales costs for many technical products are the order of 25% of total revenue, some more, some less, of course, effective marketing is as important as economical production or cost-conscious development. The engineer with ambition should not look on marketing as strictly a salesman's game. Many highly effective salesmen I have known really don't care for the paperwork and planning which must go into effective marketing. Many more businesses, by the way, go sour because of inadequate marketing than due to technical inadequacies in their products. And more firms are successful because of effective marketing than because of technical superiority of product. The computer industry is one of the better examples. There are a couple of other points I'd like to mention before moving on. One point has to do with competition. In technical product areas, marketeers must depend on engineering people to keep an eye on the competition. Too often, engineering staffs go happily along, hoping that there is no competition and carefully staying away from trade shows and conferences to make sure they don't hear of any competition. While this helps them maintain the myth that no one else has such bright ideas, it can be disastrous. Better to stop or to redirect an uncompetitive product program now than to lose your shirt later. Another caution to the would-be marketeers among you: coherent product line planning is very important. This means having the products to back up your customers' needs for expansion or their desires for other products from you. It means timing the introduction of products which are related so as to get the maximum reinforcement of sales of one product by others. IBM is a whiz at this sort of thing. Don't get carried away, however, with the coherency of product line planning. Price your products on a standalone basis with an acceptable profit level built into each one of them, because your loss leader could be your biggest seller. I now arrive at one of my favorite topics, planning. I did quite a bit of it and remember it with some pleasure. Many corporate heads are frightened of the very word planning, for it suggests plotting a future over which they have but very limited control. These people don't understand what planning is all about. Most corporations occasionally produce some kind of plan, too often just an abbreviated financial plan which shows a comfortable and steady rate of growth for the stock analyst. Some firms' plans are just wish books, like Sears catalogs, without any real basis. Plans based on historical rates of growth or plans which just list exciting things to do don't do anyone much good. Effective plans must lay out the environment the firm operates in and expects to operate in, the resources which will be available to it, and the products which will make its impact in time sequence. A secret to effective corporate planning is to break down the entire company's plans into smaller parts, say one for each existing and contemplated product line. It's not so difficult to plan what products will be sold in the next 5, 7, or 10 years, because these products usually now exist in the research and development organizations. As one moves farther out in time, plans get more difficult to derive. The wise management does not expect great accuracy or great detail about the far future. It can't get it. Forget it. Good planning is a careful evaluation of future opportunities, governed by anticipated constraints and modulated by anticipated risks, including dollars, competition, technical resources, sales capabilities, and so on. A good plan does not predict the future, but it does show a most likely course as well as some realistic alternatives and gives management the ability to plot a course from these alternatives. Some managements view planning as nothing but a time-wasting chore, and consequently they give it only lip service, and their people follow suit. Planning can be very productive, especially in two areas. First, it can alert management to important opportunities or impending crises early enough to take action. Secondly, plans can serve in a large company, particularly in one which is spread out over the globe, can serve as a valuable medium for communication up, down, and across management lines. To be truly effective, planning includes information flow both up and down the management lines and also across the organization chart. This process is best kicked off by top management describing the corporate aspirations and resource limitations to those working under them. Then, subject to whatever limitations are imposed, the product responsible forces pull together their story of what they plan to do. The planning process itself must be designed so that important dependencies of one group on another are recognized. And I believe that not only the product people, but also the research people should plan. For example, manufacturing plans will depend on development plans, and research should state its views early enough in the process that they can get factored into the development plans. After a calculated amount of plan reviewing and massaging to make sure that everyone who needs to know does know, the plans may be approved and a respite in the planning process given until the next time around. Management, of course, must see that enough heads are bumped together, that any impending problems are brought into the open for their swift correction. Engineering people can learn a great deal via the planning process. You should be able to see just how your top management views the corporate goals, and that should be written so as to be clear to you. You will have to put your plans into a clear economic perspective, with guidance, of course. And perhaps most important, you should have an opportunity to defend your proposals in a business-oriented council, benefiting from the management visibility and also from the satisfaction of structuring the future of your company. I've rambled through some of the business aspects of doing engineering successfully, because successful engineering is never done in a business failure. They only think it's successful engineering. Now, as I close, I must come down hard on what the typical engineer needs to correct in his way of doing business. I'll grant that all engineers are intelligent, creative, see what I'm doing? I'm soaping you up, hardworking, motivated, and awfully nice guys. Nice guys don't win ball games. Here are six things that I picked from a slightly larger list that you sometimes do wrong as you practice the business of engineering. One, you overemphasize technical niceties. The engineer may be the only one to know that the circuit really will perform 100% over specs. Two, you sometimes neglect the formula profit equals income minus outgo. Sure, the engineering department needs to go up 20%, but where's the money going to come from? The United Fund? Three, you are over-optimistic with respect to technical feasibility of new products. We've already shown 6 dB in the lab, so we should be able to spec it at 10 dB. Four, you tend to be over-optimistic with respect to schedules. Okay, but that means we'll have to do phases 4, 5, and 6 in a week and a half. Five, you may forget about the convenience of the user and the serviceman. Harry, if you can see that micro-mini pot under the flat pack, anybody can. Six, you may neglect manufacturing requirements. Well, that's the way the boys in the shop polished up the prototype, and it sure does look good when you take the covers off. Business errors? Hell no, they're just as much engineering errors. Engineering isn't simply an exercise to see if something can be done. It must be done within constraints, including cost and time. The good engineer and the capable engineering manager practice good business in their daily jobs. It's a responsibility of their higher management to establish an environment in which a keen awareness of sound business practice is a natural way of life. Good engineering practice must be made synonymous with good business practice. Cutting costs is an important goal, but product safety and advertised specifications must be kept in mind. Management must also see that engineering managers have an opportunity to interact with others in management in such a way as to emphasize the interdependence of engineering, marketing, manufacturing, and finance, and a whole lot of others, no doubt. Finally, I must reiterate that business is a relatively unscientific but very pragmatic pursuit. Nonetheless, technical know-how can be applied to great business benefit. And it often takes an executive with a technical background to really realize the possibility of its application. There is a future home for your technical talents in the executive suite, but you must be prepared to deal with people from widely varied backgrounds. To really be useful, you'll need to know much about how they think and make decisions. And by the way, a low but adaptable golf score is definitely no handicap.